Welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's Suzanne Muchen in for my friend Steve Bertrand, who I believe is back in action tomorrow. So I have one of my favorite people in the studio. And what I love is Bella Gandhi, who's the founder of Smart Dating Academy. She can talk about anything, and everything she has to say is something I'm interested in, and I know you will be too. So Bella, hi.
Suzanne, I'm tearing up with that amazing introduction. I'm so happy to be here.
Cutest coat. I mean, people who want to check it out, you got to take a photo of yourself. So Bella, Smart Dating Academy, tell us.
We teach people how to date. Think about it. Were you ever taught how to date at home? Were you ever taught how to pick someone that makes you happy?
No.
Most of us are probably going, no. So the ones of us that ended up with, you know, good lasting love probably kind of lucked our way into it. But what we do is we teach singles from their 20s to their 80s nationwide how to pick partners that actually make them happy. And then how do you bring your best self to the date, right? We put you online, good photos, good profile. What site should you be on? How should you show up to a date or a fundraiser, and how to meet people in real life? So that's what we do. And we see a lot of great love stories. So if you're single and you're listening and you think I'm too old, I'm too this, I'm too that, I'm telling you, there is, your other half exists. So do not lose hope.
And what I know about you too is that so much of what you teach is applicable to your whole life, not just to your dating life, to your work life, to your social life, right?
It's absolutely true, Suzanne. So I was thrust into leadership at a family business at a very young age and really didn't know how to work well with people and teams. Again, things were
shocking. So hard to imagine now, this polished businesswoman.
So, well, to that point, I read. I'm a voracious reader. I was always the kid in the self-help aisle, but learning how to show up, how to be kind to people, both in your spoken language, written language, all over. And I built that into our dating curriculum. And now, as you and I have had many interesting talks about, Suzanne, our dating clients are now getting promoted. They're getting bigger bonuses. They close bigger deals because they show up to work in a kinder, more what I call socially generous way. So yes, all of this helps you in every aspect of your life.
I love it. We're going to get to a topic I know we both want to talk about, which is the technology that is being used out there.
Dun, dun.
We'll get to that. But first, I want to talk about it's a phenomenon that I think is more and more common because we spend so much of our day at work, where people end up in these relationships at work, which could be two women, two men, male, female, but people tend to call it your work spouse, right?
Yes.
It's a relationship that seems to be as intimate and as, you know, familiar as perhaps your relationships outside of work. I am fascinated by your take on whether or not you think this is a good idea. So if a client came to you and said, you know, I don't really know if I need to be dating. I mean, I have all of what I need at my office. How do you respond to that?
Well, then I would say, are you dating this person? Because if your work spouse has the potential to be your spouse, then let's have a separate conversation. But with regards to work spouses in general, I believe it's a great thing. 70% of psychologists believe that work spouses contribute to a more positive working environment. Now, can those relationships cross the line? Absolutely. But the bulk of them don't. So I'm a big fan of the work spouse. And for those of you who don't know what a work spouse is someone who is your partner at work. Like Suzanne said, it could be a man, could be a woman, but this is the person that has your back at work. They're the person you want to tell when something goes awesomely, the person you want to tell when something is awful, the person who is going to snag you a piece of pizza when somebody brings it in if you're on an extraordinarily long conference call. That is your work spouse.
Yes. I have one.
And we love your work spouse.
We love my work spouse, Rachel. So the boundary is really the key. But I'm also hearing you say something interesting, which is don't kid yourself into thinking that that is, in fact, a real substitute for a loving, intimate relationship.
Exactly. It is a great relationship, but again, it's not intimate in the physically intimate sense. It can be emotionally intimate with regards to work issues and how you feel. But if you feel yourself crossing the line, and if you're a married person, you have to really look inward. People ask me about this all the time. I'm like, you have to look at your intentions. Am I attracted to this person? Number one, right? Am I sharing more with this person than I am with my spouse? And am I doing something that I would be angry that my spouse did? Then you might fall into that 7% of relationships that do cross the line.
So we only have a few minutes. I know. So here's what I need to ask you. What is the latest, greatest, what is your favorite new dating app out there?
Well, for those of you who know me in Smart Dating Academy, we're big believers in online dating with as a part of your dating life, because one in three marriages today take place because of online connections. So my current favorite apps are free. All you need is an iPhone or an Android. Bumble is amazing. It was founded by one of the original co-founders of Tinder. But ladies, listen in. It puts women in the driver's seat.
Yeah.
Women are the only ones that can initiate messages after you actually get a match, meaning you say, I like you, and he says, I like you. Then women, you've got 24 hours to initiate a message to that guy, or guess what? Poof, he vaporizes. So it puts you in the driver's seat, and you got to drive the car fast. You got 24 hours. So I love this. It's free. It's easy. All you need is a Facebook account, and you can be on a Bumble date tomorrow.
Wow. It's a brave new world. And ladies in the driver's seat, that's going to be my big takeaway. Bella Gandhi, Smart Dating Academy. They can find Smart Dating Academy online.
Look us up on Facebook. You can like our page, Smart Dating Academy. Follow us on Instagram at Smart Dating Academy. We post lots of free information and lots of helpful tips that'll help you to build your confidence and get out there.
I follow them everywhere, and I'm not even dating. Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's Suzanne Muschen in for Steve Bertrand. And we have Bill Geiger of Geiger Wealth Management in the studio. And Bill, I have to say, I always get a little nervous when you come in, because I think you're about to tell me that I need to be doing something that I'm not yet doing with regard to my retirement. My palms are seriously a teeny bit sweaty.
Come on.
I'm being serious.
That's not true.
It's true. So you're here, and let's talk a little bit about covering expenses in retirement. And this is why I get nervous. First of all, so I'm in my late 40s, mm-hmm. and I'm positive that my impression of what my expenses are going to be 20 years from now are not accurate.
Well, most people have this conception that their expenses are going to go down in retirement. And it's really not true. In our experience, people spend the same amount of money or maybe even more in retirement. Sure, you're not going out to a lunch that frequently outdoors, but you've got grandchildren, you've got travel, and frequently people's expenses are higher than what they did while they were working.
And what is the top expense that you think people aren't expecting?
It's not so much the top expense. Maybe it's travel, maybe it's family, maybe it's that sort of thing. You know, our firm focuses exclusively on working with couples in their late 50s to early 60s to prepare for retirement. And what we find is that most people don't have a really good handle on what it's going to cost them in retirement. But even more importantly, they don't have a good handle on where that income is going to come from to pay for their bills. I was sitting down with a couple last week, 60-year-old couple, $1 million portfolio. And I asked them, I said, what's your plan for paying your bills every month in retirement? How are you going to do this? And they stopped for a moment, and the guy kind of had this little nervous laugh. He goes, well, he says, we're planning on just pulling money out of our account every month and kind of keeping our fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Keeping your fingers crossed?
Not a good plan.
That's a little scary.
Okay.
You know, if you think about how long people are living, retirement is kind of sort of like 20 to 25 years of unemployment. We lose your job.
Now you see why my hands are sweaty when you come in here.
You lose your job, there's no more checks, right?
Right.
Well, you retire.
Right.
There's no more checks either. So, you know, is your money going to last? Will you have enough for it to last? And couples really need a plan so they don't run out of money and so they can sleep at night and enjoy the retirement.
And how early, typically when you come in here, you start talking about couples in their, you know, late 50s and 60s, but I would think that maybe you need clients who are a little younger.
Well, that's our focus, late 50s, early 60s, and we find at that time that retirement really is on their horizon.
And on their minds, you're saying.
And on their minds, yeah. On their minds, it's getting close enough that they're starting to have some serious thoughts about how are they going to do this? Are they going to have enough money? They're worried about whether the next big market correction changes their entire retirement plan. So that's the time period that we really focus on.
And what is a memory that you have where you gave a couple or an individual an advice and they really thanked you?
Oh, there's two. One is there was a couple that left our office after the plan was already done, and they kissed in the lobby.
Aw.
And that was really, really sweet. Another one was my wife and I were having lunch with another couple that we'd gone through the process. And the wife looked at my wife and said, you know, I feel like we just renewed our vows.
Wow.
That's good stuff. That's good stuff. Suzanne, I know you're going to talk about this in just a moment, but I'd like to do something special for our audience that's listening today. For the next five callers who call in, and you're going to give the phone number, who have at least $500,000 in their portfolio, I'm going to sit down with them personally on a complimentary basis and help them put together a full-blown plan for their retirement, including an income plan, to help them understand exactly where they're at right now and what they kind of sort of should be doing going forward.
Are you doing that specially for me because I'm here?
I'm doing it especially for you.
I feel like that was sort of a treat because you're here with me.
Absolutely.
Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's Suzanne Muschen in for Steve Bertrand. And I just feel like it's sort of like a party today because I've been able to bring into the studio some of my very favorite people in work and in life. No pressure, Jeff Nagel, Dr. Jeff Nagel. So Jeff Nagel is a good friend and a well-respected professional here in Chicago. He's the president and CEO of Erickson Institute. And Jeff, first of all, welcome to my party.
Well, thank you. Yeah, nice to join the party.
Really wanted to have you here for quite a while. But this topic that's on the news right now is something I knew you'd be one of the best people to talk about. So it's come out that New York City is actually going to attempt to provide preschool universally, so for all three-year-olds, and I thought that was pretty amazing news, and wondered, what was your take on that? I mean, do you look at that news and think that this is amazing progress, or are you skeptical?
Well, kind of all of the above, but it's a really exciting moment in the country when a city the size of New York, our biggest city, is saying we're going to provide this for all of our three-year-olds. Yeah. And I think it's, you always have to step back and put it in historical context. So in 1966, the country created Head Start for low-income children. And then in 1971, Congress passed universal child care for all kids in the country. It was going to be an entitlement. It passed bipartisan.
Yeah.
And then it was vetoed by President Nixon as they were heading into the campaign of 1972. He had just come back from China, and there was a lot more talk about communism and everything. And they were saying this was like the governmental communal care of children. And that it was about family weakening.
Sure, right.
So it all of a sudden shifted context, and it was vetoed. And here we are almost 50 years later.
It's amazing.
And now applauding a major city saying, we want to do this for three-year-olds, still leaves out a lot of children, but what an incredible big step for the country if they can do this.
And are you skeptical? I mean, New York City, it just seems like that is a massive number of kids.
Right, so when Mayor de Blasio there was elected, he had one of his key initiatives being universal four-year-old, you know, pre-K for four-year-olds. And they rolled that out in 2 years for about 70,000 children, which was the same question then. It was, how are you going to do this on that scale? And they really did a remarkable job, all things considered. They kept their eye on the ball for quality, teacher qualifications. You know, they used the community providers in addition to the school-based providers. And they were able to do it. Now, this program is, the headlines is universal for all three-year-olds, but they have a very slow phase-in. So New York City is one school district, but they really have 32 community districts. So they're going to start with two of those 32, and then each of the next 3 years add two more, so that by the end of it, they've got eight of the 32. That's what the city can afford. They're saying the price tag for that is about $177 million, but that they would need $1 billion to do it for the 62,000 three-year-olds that they would expect in the program, and they would need state and federal money for that as well.
And isn't part of the issue, which I want you to talk to me about this also from the perspective of Erickson Institute, that there's an issue with providing quality educators, right? I mean, it's one thing to just have the celebration of wanting to do this for kids, and then there's the reality of putting quality teachers in the classroom, which is, I know, you know, what Erickson is built to do, been doing for 50 years.
That's right. So we're in our 50th year, and we started, you know, really to support children and families, and that focus was on the workforce. And in addition to that, serving children and families and working in the schools. We work in 60 schools and serve about 7,000 to 10,000 children a year. But that is, when you have 62,000 new right. kids in universal care, where's the workforce for that? And they're talking about 4,500 teachers they're going to need. So that is a huge mountain to climb. And, you know, again, you have to give them credit. They were able to do it for the four-year-old program, but that is going to take a lot of attention. And you have to really pay attention to the wages, the compensation, and that's been a struggle for them there and
right.
everywhere. The community-based providers, are they paid the same? Are their teachers paid the same as the school-based providers?
Right.
And that's usually not the case, and that creates a big disparity there, and that has to be addressed. And that's really one of the key struggles in the country. We demand quality childcare, but are we paying appropriate compensation yeah. for the qualified teachers?
And I have to ask this because you're here. Is there any hope for Chicago? I mean, you must read this, you, Jeff, you mm-hmm. must read this and think to yourself, well, could that happen here? What's your take?
Well, Chicago's been doing great things. I mean, Mayor Emanuel really supports early childhood education and early childhood development. In their first term, they got to full-day kindergarten, and then they started implementing universal pre-K for four-year-olds, but
right.
that was a half-day program. So their next big step is to get that to be a full-day program, and then you can start talking about, you know, is the ambition to get that to three-year-olds. I think they have plans to get to that full day, and I think they have some plans for three-year-olds, and, you know, time will tell. But obviously, in the context of what's going on in Illinois with
right.
the budget and then the budget for the schools, it's, you know, the odds are long. Even in a perfect world, then you put on those financial pressures. I don't know if it can happen, but I think we have a leader here in the city who would really like to make that happen. And now that it's happening in New York, you know, does it put pressure on the city and all of our leaders to follow suit
yeah.
and really step up and do that?
And is the public will there? I mean, do you think if you went out onto Michigan Avenue and there was a, you know, group of people, does the average person believe that this is necessary? Have we gone to the place where the understanding of the importance of those early years is, you know, common sense today?
Well, I've been aware of polls for 15 years that have asked people about the importance of early childhood education, and people always rank it up, way up there.
Yeah.
They'll say it's more important than cutting
yep.
taxes and other things. And, you know, the bottom line for me is if you ask any parent of any background, any income level, do you think you want to invest in your children from the first day and give them the best start? They're going to say yes.
Sure.
So on an individual level, it's there. But somehow on a collective societal level, it's not there yet. Our country spends 0.3% of our gross domestic product on early childhood education. What does that mean? Well, to put that in context of other economically developed countries, we're next to last.
Right.
Only
it's
Turkey.
Amazing.
Only Turkey spends less than we do. And to put that into a per dollar, it's about $2,400 per kid. The countries that are leading in that area, where they're spending like 1.5% of their GDP, you know, they're spending $9,000 to $11,000 per kid
yeah.
in these early years. So we're just not making that investment as a country in our children. And yet that is the foundation for the children as individuals, but for our future as a country. So I think with the right leadership, people are ready to follow that and support that. And I think that's a major first step, what we're seeing in New York right now.
And what would you say to the critics who would say, look, we all grew up and there was no universal, you know, preschool for three-year-olds, and we started school in kindergarten and we turned out fine?
Well, I think for a lot of us, we had the benefit. It wasn't universal preschool, but our parents, you know, created opportunities for us to go to some sort of preschool or nursery school or Mother's Day Out or other educational opportunities at the museums or libraries. There's no doubt that those are advantages. And if you grew up and didn't have it, do you wish you did? If you talk to your parents now and said, Mom, do you wish you could have sent me to some early education program? I bet the answer would be yes. It certainly can't hurt. And again, it just kind of better prepares you. And not just academically, but socially and how you get along with others and interact with others and feel confident and secure and just to have more experiences, because it all comes down to your experiences in childhood.
So this is an equity issue for sure.
Well, I think ultimately it is an equity issue because there's clearly a group in the population that can afford access to early childhood education, even if it's not provided to the public. And there's a lot of people that cannot. But, you know, 1971, when the universal child care passed, 40% of mothers worked. Now 70% of mothers work.
Right.
75% of single mothers work. I mean, it's a necessity in our society. And even if a mother or father were at home with their kid, do you not want to have other opportunities for the child to play with other kids and get to know other kids and interact with other educated adults who can help nurture them in so many great ways? So it's a win for everybody. And even economically, it's a win. As economists tell us, it's a great value for the public dollar in terms of the return to the public.
Dr. Jeff Nagel, that was so interesting, and thank you. And I also have to thank you. I had suggested to Jeff that he might bring me some Hostess gifts last night, and he walked in today, I must say, with Twinkies and Ho-Hos. I'm not even joking. That in and of itself.
That's a party. You said it was a party.
It is a party. So thank you so much. And when we come back, we're going to have more on the business launch. I'll be talking to Carolyn Collins, who is the CEO of UI Labs, and we'll be back after this break. Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's Suzanne Muchen sitting in for Steve Bertrand, who will be back on the show tomorrow. But this is my lucky day because I got to bring to the studio all the people who I think are super smart and awesome. And one of them is Carolyn Nowinski Collins, who is the CEO of UI Labs. If you haven't seen it, you're missing out. This is the enormous facility on Goose Island. And Carolyn is here in the studio after writing an incredible op-ed. Am I allowed to mention our competitors? It was in the Sun Times. Yeah, Bennett's saying that's okay. A phenomenal op-ed. And here's what I'm fascinated about, Carolyn, is so you were writing about what's really going to be the opportunity to address infrastructure issues, which is, you know, we think of infrastructure, I think trucks, I think, you know, men building things on roads, but there's an enormous opportunity for technology to be used.
Yeah, technology today is a huge part of infrastructure. And when we think about making these huge investments, if we're going to invest $1 trillion into infrastructure over the coming years, we've got to do it smart. And the way to do it smart is to not just bring in new roads, but to take those roads and put in sensors and new data collection methods so we can actually figure out how to be smarter about our transportation needs.
And these technologies, I've heard the term smart cities. Is that, but here in Chicago at UI Labs, you have a smart cities project, right, called City Digital. Is that what City Digital is looking at?
Yeah, so City Digital was actually formed to look at what is the future of a smart city look like and how do we get there faster? Cities know that there's all sorts of opportunities, but it's really hard to deploy these new technologies in cities, whether we're talking about sensors or we're talking about new data analytics, these cloud computing. We hear these buzzwords and we don't really know how to apply those to a city.
Right.
And city government is not exactly the quickest to take up these things. The city of Chicago has been really forward thinking and has actually been at the forefront of this whole smart cities movement. But we recognize there was an opportunity to bring the city together with companies, big companies and small companies, residents and policymakers, universities and startup innovators to figure out how we can get there faster. How can we actually create that smart city in Chicago as quickly as possible?
So they come together, they work together in sort of a third space, right? UI Labs houses them and allows this interesting group of people to come together and have these conversations. And so what's coming out now? I know that City Digital has a couple of really interesting new innovations, right?
Yeah. Our whole goal is to design these collaborative experiences that bring new technology to life. So we just announced some results of a pretty exciting project where we're mapping the underground of Chicago.
I saw that. That's so, really?
So there's a lot going on beneath our streets. I mean, besides the rats. Besides the rats. After the Chicago fire, we rebuilt the city on top of itself, right? So we've got, you know, old telecom lines. We've got wooden water pipes. We've got, obviously, you know, new, you know, electricity and power and gas and all of that. And in the U.S., the stats say that every 60 seconds, something gets hit below ground. And so that means
that's terrifying.
Think about when, you know, the power goes out on the east side of the city, right, and you don't know what happened. Well, it was probably some digging, some construction site, you know, down the road. And so how can we make sure that these things don't happen and don't disrupt your commute to work or don't disrupt your, you know, ability to watch your favorite TV show? And so we are looking at how we can use technology, which now allows us to have a real-time map of what's going on.
That's really cool.
Every time a construction worker opens up the street, they can use their smartphone, take a photo of what's going on. That photo, that data gets uploaded to a platform that allows us to create a real-time map of the underground of Chicago.
And I assume the construction workers want this technology. Won't it make their work easier?
Oh, absolutely. You're actually going to know, is that pipe actually where we think it is? Or we didn't think there was a pipe there.
Right.
And we need to figure out how to navigate around it. Maybe if we dig 5 feet over, maybe that's the place to dig instead.
So this occurred recently at our building, three families in our building. Some construction workers came out to address what they said they thought was a water problem. Once they developed this massive hole in the middle of our street, only to find that the problem was so intense that they had to shut the water off on our entire block. Thousands and thousands of people affected. In addition to my neighbors downstairs who had a newborn baby, no water.
Yeah. And then they're probably going to go tear up the street again next summer. And so what if we can plan a little bit better if we know where these things are and figure out how to use new technology to make our city smarter?
Carolyn Iwinski-Collins, I think you have a really fun job.
It is the best job. I have to pinch myself every day.
I mean, I'm sure it's hard. It sounds really hard and complicated, but it's phenomenal. So UI Labs, are there tours?
We bring in public groups all the time.
Oh,
so there's all sorts of events going on. Check out our website, uilabs.org. And yeah, really cool space and really an asset to the city. So come on by.
Yeah, I think if you haven't gone by, it's a real gem in the city and you should take a look. Carolyn, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.